problems surrounding the issue of of when the Kohalim quit in the middle of the contracted period.
Okay.
And what we saw was that if the work that they leave undone is construed as an irreparable loss, as a davar ha'aved, then there's no difference between a sakhir and a kablan. They both can be held liable for the amount it costs the employer to replace their work, at least up to the amount of their salary. However, if it's not a davar ha'aved, if the employer doesn't suffer an irreparable loss by waiting until the next day and hiring more workers at the market price, then we saw that there was a difference between a sahir and a kablan. That is, a wage earner, an employee, is protected by Rav's rule that po'el chozer bo afilu b'chatzi hayom, that he suffers no penalty for stopping in the middle of the day. Whereas a kablan, if a person is employed as a piece worker or as a contractor, then if he stops in the middle of the job, he can be penalized to the extent of the extra costs that the balabayit incurs by having to switch workers in the middle. That was the summary of the position of the Gemara, of the conclusion of the Gemara, and that led us to a number of things that we have to clarify. We were sort of in the middle last time of clarifying exactly what is a sakhir and exactly what is a kablan. In other words, what is the operative definition of a worker as opposed to a contractor? And we'll finish, we'll deal a little bit more with that this evening. Then we have to deal with the this business of socher alehem o mata'an, in other words, the ability to deceive on work contracts when there's a certain amount of blackmail involved on the part when you're being held up by the worker, for example. And then we also have to discuss the issue of what indeed the situation is of Yadam al Hatachtona. So those are the three issues that I would like to conclude tonight before moving on to the next topic, which will be in 3 weeks' time.
2 weeks'
time, yeah. So the what did we see last time? Last time we saw, first of all, or 2 weeks ago, we saw that when we're discussing medical group practice, the issue of how binding such a contract was, we saw that as a side consequence of that, the Maharik says that the principle that po'el chozer bo afil b'chatzi hayom, that is avadai hein v'lo avadim l'avadim, does not apply when the master and servant, so to speak, are on the same level. That is, even though the Rashba wanted to deliberately apply it to a situation where every person had hired himself out to someone else, the Maharik came to the conclusion that since in group practice you might have theorized that the reason why the contract is binding is that each one is everybody else's employee, since in fact no one is a master over the other, but they all have equal status, then Rav's principle, which was meant to protect the weak employee against the strong Baal HaBayit, does not apply in that situation. The second thing that we learned last week was that from the tshuva of the Rav Yitzchak bar Rav Shmuel on the issue of the Melamed, we saw last week that he poses the difference between a sakhir and a poel as to who's the master of his own time. If you have to punch a time clock and work from 9 a.m. to noon, then you would be considered a sakhir, because at least during that period of time, you don't have your time is not your own. You have to do whatever the boss tells you to do during that time period, and those types of workers are protected by Rav. But if you are hired to do a specific task, even though that task may be somewhat time-limited, but you're paid by the accomplishment of a task. If you're told to teach a child to get ready for his bar mitzvah parsha, and you're paid a lump sum for the job, but you don't have to do it at any specific time that's fixed by the boss, but rather that's fixed at your convenience, then you're considered a kablan and not a sakhir. We also saw from the tshuva of the Truma Sadeshin that a person who is, again, it was a side issue, it wasn't the main principal concern of his. We learned a lot of other interesting things from that shuvah, but we saw that a person who has to finish a job within a narrowly confined time period, nevertheless, if the terms of the employment are by the product rather than by the time, he's still considered a kablan and not a safir. The example that we had there was a person who was sent to supervise and produce kosher wine. Obviously, it could only be done during the 2 or 3 week harvest period when the grapes were actually harvested and before they were all pressed. So he had to get his 10 barrels done in that short 2 week period. Nevertheless, the Tumas Sadeshan says that he's considered a safir and not a kablan. I want to continue with these tshuvot that I passed out last time to see a couple of other cases. One has to do with a chazan. Well, I'll need them back because I passed them. You weren't here last night. No. Okay, but
what was the reason why considering a sakir and not a
kablan? Who? No, he said it was a kablan and not a sakir. I mean, I said, and if I said it backwards, I'm sorry. Oh, no. All right. Okay. So let's turn to my page 5. Let's turn. This is a tshuva from Rav Binyamin Ze'ev. So this, we're talking about 16th century in Turkey. Sha'alta mimeni harab Shimon Katz. Ala dotcha sheniskavta lakahal yitzu l'shliach tzibuch. You are hired by such and such a congregation to be the chazan. So basically he was hired as a shamish and a chazan. He was supposed to sexton a general factotum in the shul, to daven before the amud, and also to raise money to give to charity and presumably distribute the charity money. So more or less similar to employees that we have today in a synagogue. And you were hired v'kach v'kach l'shana. You were hired for this, a certain amount of money per year. U'kemar marucha niskarta pachot mikdei ha'ra'uy l'sriratcha. The salary was probably less than you should have deserved for such a job, but nevertheless you agreed it. U've'emtza ha'shana, the Hebrew here isn't all that great, it should say u've'emtza ha'shana amu l'cha m'munei ha'kahal she'enam chafetzim b'cha. The president, you got into some kind of a fight with the president of the shul, and he says that he doesn't want you anymore. V'gam kvodcha nitratzita. And then you agreed. You got into a fight with the president. The president told him, you're fired. And he said, okay, I'm leaving. Okay. Amno hakol haya ba'amira v'lo b'chtiva. All of this was verbal. Okay, you had a verbal exchange. The president fired him, and he said, I quit. Okay. Not an unfamiliar scenario. Ukeshishamu anshei hakahal, but when the rest of the congregation found out about this contretemps, hukshu ba'enehem, they didn't like this idea. V'lo nitratzu, they didn't like the idea of letting you go. Elo ratzu sheta'amodi mahem lepachod ad hashlamat hashana. They said that you should at least stay on the job until the end of the year. In the middle of the year, all of the chazanim are already hired. It's difficult to find a replacement. So they wanted you to stay until the end of the year. V'gam otam ha'mumunim nami chazgu behem v'ratzu li'akvacha. And then the president also changed his mind and wanted to keep you on. Okay. U'kvodcha to'en shekvar machalu shibudcha ha'mumunim. And you claim that since you were... your obligations came to an end, were terminated by being fired by the president, therefore you should not have any obligations. Hadin immi. So who's right here? Does he have to stay on the job to the end of the year on the original terms, or can he quit in the middle?
He had a contract.
Yeah, but he's a sahir. He's paid on an annual basis. Po'el chozer afilu b'chatzi hayom. Right, that's our problem here.
He doesn't want to collect anything.
He wants to quit.
Yeah,
he wants to collect his back salary and quit.
He isn't asking for the rest of the year.
No.
He wants to quit. Why is that parallel to what we were learning before?
It's always the same thing. Poel, the question is, does he have an obligation to stay on for the rest of the contract?
So now the obligation is on the poel rather than...
It's always that way. The question is, what poel chozer bo afilu b'chatzi hayom means? The poel chozer bo afilu b'chatzi hayom means that a worker has the right to quit in the middle of the day. He was hired to work from 9 in the morning until 4 in the afternoon. He quits at 12:30, and he has the right to collect half a day's salary. The fact that he causes the boss some hardship and the boss has to go out and hire other workers and has some additional expenses is not his problem. He's entitled to half a day's salary, and he can quit without penalty. That's the issue. Here it's the middle of the year. The chazan wants to quit without penalty. Is he allowed to quit without penalty? Or does he have a moral and legal obligation to finish the year? And should he not finish the year, does he have to reimburse the congregation for whatever additional expenses they might have to hire an outside chazan who are hard to come by in the middle of the year? That's the question.
Is there a factor that they told him, they were the first ones to tell him that they were not satisfied?
Yeah, that complicates the issue.
Right, okay. Because he didn't just go up and quit. They told him they didn't want it.
There are two issues.
It's all verbal.
Yeah, that's the problem. That's exactly the problem. Had they come to a signed agreement terminating the contract, both sides would be happy. There would be no case on either side. What had happened here was a combination of several things. On the one hand, the term that he was fired only verbally, whereas the contract was a solid contract. Can you terminate? So what legal bearing does that being verbally fired have? And on the other hand, the issue is, does this chazan have the status of a sakhir, of a worker? Is he protected by Rav's legislation, which says that any worker has the right to quit in the middle without penalty?
Whether fired or not.
Yeah, that's the problem.
So
lefum riata, at first blush, he says, hayani reshelo yakvucha, that they don't have the right to keep you. Mehade ita b'bava metzia v'hevianami ha'alfasi perka socheret u'manim arav halacha kravidosa arav al poer yichol lachzor v'afilu b'chatzi hayom. A worker can quit in the middle of the day. V'shamim lo et masha asa, my timer dektiv ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim v'lo avadim l'avadim. So that's the first reason why, at first blush, you should have the right. You should always be careful. The first blush means that the answer is going to be the opposite, right? But at any rate, he says here.
However,
so here are two reasons why the chazan should be allowed to quit without penalty. One was that he's protected by Rav's halacha, because after all he is an employee and not a contractor. And secondly, because he was fired. The culture came, Shamamunim Machalushi Budcha. However, Niza Le'idach Kisa. Let's look at the other side of this question. V'nomar, kevan she'akahal to'anim she'enam motzi'im shliach tzibur v'gabai tzedakah kamocha ata le'emtzaut ha'shana, since they can't find a suitable replacement in the middle of the year, v'habi lehu k'davar ha'aved, so therefore, as far as they are concerned, this is an irreparable loss. There's no market in chazanim in the middle of the year. Eincha yechol lachzor b'cha. You cannot quit. In question whether it's an irreparable loss, afilu poel enu yechol lachzor bo. Va'od nireh lahavir ayam itam acher sheincha yechol zvuha, shahal kevan shelo nimchal shibudcha b'ktiva ki im ve'amira. This is what Dr. Schwager said. Since there was only a verbal termination of that contract, the verbal termination of a written contract has no legal status. Well, I don't know.
I mean, there's a written contract, but he's not a contractor. I mean, there is another, right? I mean,
he has a firm agreement with the congregation. They're obligated to pay him. He's obligated to work. The question is whether you can terminate that by simply the president saying, getting up to him and saying, you're fired. The question is what status that verbal you're fired can have.
The president can more easily replace.
Right.
No, but what makes the contract? If a contract document does not make the contract, that being a contractor?
No, you're confusing the words. Contract simply means that people are in agreement. Let's use the word agreement and not contract.
But
there was a written agreement between him. Okay? There was a written agreement between them. Right? Or some other form of agreement. It doesn't matter. There was a valid agreement between them. And then, without putting anything in writing, the president said, you're fired. And now he changed his mind. The question is whether the president has given up all the rights of the congregation by simply saying that he fired. And as Dr. Schwaber says, that's not the case. You have to have something a little bit more substantial than simply a verbal, you're fired, in order to terminate the agreement. In this case, the fact that you need something more substantial works to the disadvantage of the employee, because it means that the congregation has not given up his rights. Yes. So he then goes to prove all of this from the Gemara and Ketubot and elsewhere. Let's not go into the details of his argument. Okay.
What's the irreparable harm?
They can't find a replacement in the middle of the year.
Can you hire a woman?
A collection.
No, he's saying that since that's right, he's saying that if it's a davar ha'aved, then the fact that you're a sahir is irrelevant. Okay. Okay. So let's skip to the next paragraph. All right. The alta anatcha. That your wage is below the suitable wage, the shayach pacha onaha, and that therefore you should be able to nullify the contract because there was a certain amount of fraud here. You're being paid less than the suitable market rate. Nireh la niatayti de baholo shayach onaha. The kogon. That a claim of fraud to invalidate a worker's contract is can't be sustained. Okay.
Not generally.
I mean, certainly we can be a case against the fraud. But what he might sue for back wages. But to cancel the working agreement on the basis of being underpaid, that is not a valid, since he agreed to it.
He signed the contract, exactly.
Why does underpayment, even admitting that it's underpayment, why does that constitute fraud?
Well, if for example, I sell you, fraud doesn't necessarily mean deliberate fraud. It just simply means something that a normal person under similar market conditions would not agree to. I simply made a mistake. Right. If you overcharge me or undercharge me, doesn't matter. But suppose you have a store and you overcharge me. You charged me twice as much as the thing is naturally worth. I don't know, and maybe you didn't know. But if there's a substantial deviation from the market price, even though there was no intent to defraud, that contract is invalid. Okay, so he's claiming here that since he was paid substantially below the market rate, that contract should be invalid. But of course, as Mr. Weinstein says, he was aware of his wits at the time, so that he might make some claim for restitution of back pay, but this should not invalidate the contract. Okay, and then finally he says that his last argument here is that the president doesn't have the right arbitrarily to fire this man, at least to relieve all of the congregation of his services. I mean, after all, the president might have gotten into a fight with him, but it's the whole shul that has to go without a chazan for the rest of the year. So that therefore, his obligation may very well be that the president no longer has any personal obligation to the president, but his obligation to the rest of the community is still binding. Okay, so that's one shuba. And now I want to look at an even more difficult shuba from Rav Kook. This is a shuba, the next page, by page 7. I didn't know this.
That sounds amusing. Yes.
Okay. It's an interesting shiva, but it's not relevant. I mean, the question is bingo, right? The guy promised not to gamble, and then what happens if the shul is running a bingo party? That's the next shiva. You might be interested, but right? It wasn't bingo, it was craps, right? It was dice, right? A man took an oath not to play, not to gamble, and now...
Does it include shul-sponsored activity?
No, but anyway. Okay, let's go on to the next tshuva that's of interest to us here. All right. So this is a tshuva that Rav Kook wrote as a young man. He was still in Latvia. This is written at the end of the 1890s, before he moved to Eretz Yisrael. And it's an interesting tshuva because he raises some points, and I think that many of the other things that he says is fairly far-fetched. Let's read. Let's first see what the case is. Ra'oi leva'er be'ezrat Hashem b'din rab shekibel k'tav rabbanut me'eza kehila acharei shekvar nigmar zman hitkashruto im b'nei adato hayishana. Man was a rabbi in a small congregation, and after his term of service in that congregation is up, or he had signed or a contract with a different congregation, or at least the contract that he signed was only to go into force after his term of employment in the current congregation had ended, right? Im bnei ha'ir yishana rosha'im la'akvo shiyachzor bo v'yishar etzlam v'im hu rosha'i letzayet lahem. He signed the contract.
For 1 year, the year is up.
No. You misunderstand. He is the rabbi of let's say, the Maimonides shul. And now he gets a contract for a much bigger and better shul, the Young Israel. So he signed the contract with the Young Israel.
So what?
And now, the Maimonides wants him to stay on for another year, and he wants to cancel the contract that he signed with the Young Israel.
Maimonides, you can't.
Well, that's the problem. Why shouldn't he? It's the same principle. If Poel Choseo Bo Vavachilu
Vachatz... Contract. That's the purpose of the contract.
But our question is, Rab's halacha is Poel Choseo Bo Vavachilu Vachatzi Hayom.
But not under contract.
Well, certainly with a contract.
Otherwise, of course, your issue wouldn't arise.
Rab's halacha is that even though there's a contractual relation between the worker and the employer, it's a one-sided obligation. The employee can quit in the middle of the day without penalty. That's Rav's halach. And now the question here is whether that extends to Rabbanim. Is a rabbi a yisachir? Is he to be construed as an employee to fall under the under Rav's protective? What's the problem, Mr. Fee?
So
what
did he just try to... So what did the shayla there?
The previous one was a similar question, and it was resolved because it was construed that it was a davar ha'aved. In the previous question, it was taken, A, there was a valid contract, and B, it was a davar ha'aved. If he was a chazan in the middle of the year, we don't know. Rav Kook may decide that this is also a davar ha'aved. I mean, that's up to the judge in the individual case. He will say, for example, what's going to happen in this tshuva is that Rav Kook is going to try to let his moral sense of obligation to fulfill a contract override any of these other protective devices that the rabbi may have to try to wiggle out of his agreement.
So in other words, the contract is worthless.
Yes, what Rav's halacha is, a contract to force a worker to work is worthless as far as an employee is concerned when it's not a davar ha'aved.
If I hired somebody on the contract after he wants to quit, I can't force him because he's not a servant.
That's right.
There's always damages, that's all.
But Rav's halacha is that if it's not a davar ha'aved, there are no damages collected. This is like minimum wage. You may not like it, but that was Rav's legislation. Rav's halacha was Poel Choseo Bo Afilu B'Chatzi Hayom.
Even with a contract.
So that even though there's a contract, it's not enforceable on a worker. This is one of the things where Jewish law protects the worker and gives the worker an advantage over the employer. Right. What we've been studying in the last 3 weeks is how to various attempts to shave this down, right? To decide, for example, in this tshuva that we just learned, there was an assertion made that a chazan in the middle of the year is construed as an irreparable loss. The Gemara says, in the case of an irreparable loss, Rav's halacha is suspended. So is the quitting of a chazan in the middle of the year an irreparable loss to the congregation? And the Binyamin said yes. If it's an irreparable loss, then Rav's protection doesn't exist. And then in the last shiva, we saw that the Binyamin Zev agreed with Dr. Schwaber that a verbal cancellation of a firm contract is meaningless. So those two things taken together meant that the chazan in the previous tshuva was obligated to finish the year. Here, it's a slightly different situation. This rabbi hasn't gotten on to the new job yet. He hasn't even started to work, but he signed all the papers. Right? He entered into lengthy...
The papers are worthless.
No. That's the issue. Are they worthless or not? That's the question. The question is whether this...
Stay tuned.
The question here is whether the rabbi is considered in the same class as a ditch digger who needs to be protected by Rav's halach. And I would say, of course, American rabbis certainly need this kind of protection. But we'll see that the picture that Rav Kook had of a European rabbi doesn't quite jive with what we see in our everyday life. You wanted to ask something, Alan?
Well, isn't there another aspect to this?
Which is?
And not only has he negotiated after the term of his original contract is over, which of course he seems to have a right to do, but he's reneging.
Well, that's the issue. Can he renege?
Okay. Right.
If poel choser bo b'chifilu b'chatzi ayom means that a worker always has the right to renege without penalty.
What difference does it make that this prospective employer is one whom you worked for previously? Or could be just
doesn't make any difference.
No, that's not a factor. Right?
Okay.
According to the previous rule, would that extend to the rabbi instead of the chazan?
In the middle of the year, maybe. Yeah. I mean, we'll see that one of the things that Rav Kook will say here is that, in fact, it is considered a davar avei. If you establish that, then obviously he's obligated to fulfill his contract. But he's going to also try to establish that a rabbi is not a sakhir. The general thrust of what he's going to say is quite reasonable. In other words, am I protected by Rav's halach? I'm a professor. Most of my time is my own. I have certain time obligations to teach a certain number of hours a week. I'm not any one particular individual's employee. My standing in the community is, it may not be as high as a plumber, but it's certainly relatively high, all things being equal. And therefore, I should probably not be construed as a person who's needful of Rob's protection. In other words, the issue here is that maybe my situation as being a professor at Harvard University is like a doctor in the group practice that the Marik discussed last time, that Rav's original legislation was never meant to extend to people in my position. So the issue here, above and beyond the question of Davaha Aved that Rav Kook wants to establish, and it's one of the things that he will attempt to establish, is that the rabbi in a community should not be construed as a lowly employee, and therefore Rav's protection doesn't extend to him. We'll see, but it's amusing to see how he tries to establish the details of this.
You can't have protection and status at the same time.
That's right. Okay. Ikar hadin hu mehodi amar rav, ho'el yachol lachzor afilu b'chatzi hayom, mitam avadai heim v'lo avadim lehodim. Hachinami nireh, af al pi shenichtav haktav harabanut al meshech zman, mikol mokom yachol lachzor. Zeh nireh lefum riyata. That's the first blush view. Aval, however, kad daikit be, as you, when you look into the matter a little bit further, nimtza kama ta'amim nechonim v'kayimim shebenidan dedan eino yachol lachzor bo umuchuyav l'kayim tna'o umutzo sotav. Yivikol shekein ma shekibel v'chtavu v'yotzele. There are various reasons to argue against ruling that Rav's protection applies to a rabbi. Chada, it's not clear to me that the position of being a rabbi should be construed as a daily worker. That we should treat a rabbi as a contractor, as a professional, rather than as an employee. The reason that we believe that the Rav's protection applies to a wage earner rather than a person who, a piece worker, a person who's a contractor, mitam, shehakablan eino eved ki im la'atzmo. Really, a contractor is self-employed. He's not really employed by the purchaser of the work, he is rather selling the end product of his labor, but he is self-employed. And he says, this is a strange ruling, but he's saying that it applies only to someone who has to work the whole day long, punch a time clock, come in at 9 and leave at 6, and doesn't have any free time during the day. Ma she'eino kein v'rabanut, she'rak ha'chovo olav l'horot kol dvar she'elat isur v'heter, the only job that a rabbi has is the paskin shaylis, decide, v'ladun kol din Torah she'iz damein, or settle any legal dispute that arises, v'anu yodim she'harbeiz man nimtzeh panui, she'ein bo avodat ha'tzibur klal. A lot of rabbi has a huge amount of free time in which he's not working for the community at all. In kein hadat notein she'ein schirat ha'rabanut al hazman. Therefore, it stands to reason that when a rabbi is paid, he's not paid for the amount of time that he puts in. Ki im al inyan hamulachot ha'pu'ulot she'alav la'asot. But rather, he is paid for the specific tasks that he does, but he is not being paid by the hour. In other words, even though he may be getting a weekly wage or a monthly wage or a yearly wage, he's really being paid for the tasks he's performing, but not on an hourly basis. Im kein enoki im eved la'atzmo. If that's our interpretation, then he's a slave to himself, but not to the congregation. So, I mean, this is a shaky point, of course, but there's some validity to it, since the time scale here is flexible. That it's similar to what we saw last week in the Tumat Adeshin. If a man took upon himself to produce wine during the harvest season, even though he really has to work all during the harvest season, but the real contract was only to produce wine, and his wages are for the wine. Of course, this certainly is not similar to the case at hand, because there he was paid by the barrel. He was paid for a specific number of barrels. Here the rabbi is not paid for the specific number of shilus that he has.
He's on tap.
Okay.
He's like a consultant.
Like a consultant. But the question is a consultant considered a wage earner, or is he considered a free professional who's selling his advice? So that's basically the problem here. Even though the reading of the Tumat Adeshin was that he's being paid by the barrel and not by the hour, since all Dinei Torah, there is a fee that comes off the top that goes to the rabbi who decides the case. That's what it says. I'm just describing the situation and custom in Eastern Europe, where the Rabbanim decided Dinei Torah between various individuals, and they received a fee for deciding it. Just like here, we have the strange custom that you give a rabbi a fee for performing a marriage. Right? I mean, isn't it rather weird that a rabbi collects a fee for officiating at a funeral or for performing a marriage? In fact, he was got it from both sides. Im kein yesh al zech chiyuv kablanut. V'lami yigarek kol chol ma sheyesh lo otz chivut nosaf l'kol shavua. V'bikomokom b'meh pakash yibudo sheyesh olav mitzad shenitchayev ladun kol din Torah u'lekaber d'mei psak kanahug. Im kein al zeh yesh lo din kablanut mamash. He says that it's true that this man may be a wage earner, but a substantial portion of the rabbi's income comes from being available to decide questions and be to perform weddings and divorces and all of those things, and there he's paid by the individual activity. So since he obligated himself to be available to do all of these services, and he's paid by the piece for each of these services, then maybe from the point of view of his annual salary he has the right to quit, but from the point of view of his undertaking to be available to do work by the piece, he stops. That's also relatively strange, because the idea of a poel, of a kablan not being able to zero is for the individual piece, right? It's not saying that to be on call. So he's trying to extend the idea of a kablan to the idea of a doctor being on call and then being paid for the house visits or the hospital visits. I guess that's the main way in which doctors are actually paid, right? Rather than being on salary from the hospitals.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
turn this all into you think you need Rob's protection. Okay.
But here if you applied this to the lowliest caste of workers, like someone who's shaping up for agricultural work, you would see that there's a there's a loss here. I mean,
yes, sure.
A weakness here.
Sure. The old nirala ladati. The lo mistaver klam lefo liyata lutot in yana avodutah b'lashon haschivot v'lomar im shiyaseh lo yayin kol abatsiv yitlo mikol chafikach v'zeh lo yichashev avdut. V'gam kishayin lo He's saying, why indeed, in a situation like the one that the Trumas HaDeshen is describing, and this is, I think, your point, why indeed should it make a difference whether the formal terms of the contract was that he's going to be paid for the three-week period or he's going to be paid by the barrel, when in fact, in either case, he has to work full-time to produce the barrels and he doesn't have a minute's spare time. V'nirah la'diyat ha'atid al kochach ha'loka amar Trumas HaDeshen chiluk zeh ki im bedavar sheyesh avodat tamid kal hayom mamash im kein anu musupakim im scharo sheyegufo mishubad lo kal hayom ve'al zeh noten lo schar im kein u'eved o rak shescharo sheyase pulato ma shememela malei avodat kal hayom ein v'kach mishem avdot sherak et atzmo v'oved aval kol zeh ein shayach ki im bedavar sheyesh lo ma sheyibud hu al gufo sheyibud lo kidin eved b'lo zvan panoi zulat ha'mukrah. It's only talking about a case where the man is really engaged in full-time work. Ma she'eino kein ברבנות שאנו יודעים שיש הרבה זמן פנוי, ואפילו אמר סחירות על הזמן, מכל מקום אנו יודעים שלא שיבד גופו שיבד תמיד כל היום כעבד. I know that my salary doesn't require me to be working full-time for Harvard University without my being able to control my time. And therefore, the Rav Kook is saying that it's unreasonable to assume that I'm in the same category as an agricultural worker being paid by the hour and being forced to work a 12-hour day. Since, basically, the majority of my time is my own, I should not be under Rav's protection. And that's what he's saying, that a rabbi, in the main, has the freedom of time of his own, and therefore, Rav never intended to extend his ruling to this case. He's saying it's like a lawyer, right, who you might hire on a retainer on a general basis, even though in fact you're paying the lawyer for the specific legal services that he performs from time to time. And had the original contract been written that way, certainly he would be a kablan. The reason that you're doing it on a retainer basis rather than on an individual basis is just that it's too troublesome to have to calculate each individual minute and decide how much he's done and how much he hasn't done. Instead, you do it on the basis of a retainer. But therefore, the fact that you're paying the lawyer on a retainer basis rather than on a fee for the individual particular contract that he's managed or sales or appearances in court or what have you, since basically you're paying him for specific services, it's just a matter of convenience that you're paying him an annual or a monthly retainer, that doesn't make him into your sakhir. Okay. And that's also a very reasonable narrowing down of Rav's halacha. Ulevadze, he says, Yesh makom lomar shebarabanut lo shayach chazara mitam avadayhem al pidin hasma bilchot shudfin the shudfin heim shubadim lezeh lezeh ve'ino yucholim lachzor behem mitam avadayhem lo shayach avadayhem ki'im kishehu mishubad lachaveiro v'chaveiro eino mishubad lo klav. But one thing that we discovered from the Marit Shuvah is that when they all have equal partners, they're not considered as one being a master of the other. Aval shutafim shehem avadim ze lazeh, ein kan mishum avadayhem. When all of the workers in a cooperative or in a group practice, as we saw in the case of the Marik, are equally indebted to the other, the idea of calling one a slave and the other a master is not. He says the katab b'bal melacha shalakach ma'ar l'melachto v'itna she'ilamdenu melachato. If a master has taken on a young boy as an apprentice, And the conditions are that the master will teach the trade to the apprentice, and in exchange, the apprentice will work for the master. There's a mutual relationship there that the master craftsman is teaching the apprentice. Im kein yesh lo ma barav im hatzibur, sheyeshnam gam al hatzibur kama inyanei avdut shemishtavim larabah. The congregation has, after all, a whole lot of obligations to the rabbi. The relationship is not all one-sided. Nosaf al stam talmud chacham, umuchuyavim lishmor ledvarav b'kol hanhagat hakehila. They have to follow his advice on all matters of community practice. Afilu b'divrei rashut, even in secular matters, they will have to listen to the rabbi. Uve'inyanei ma'ot hatzdakot, on how to distribute the synagogue funds. Uchayotzei b'hem. I don't think he's talking about American rabbi here. Take the general picture. V'kama shibudei kavod harav, and many forms of honor that you have to give to the rabbi, sheshayach, rak l'rabba ir, v'lo l'shum tamud chacham acher, and not to any other scholar. Kol eila avdut hu mitzad atzibur. All of these are situations in which the rabbi is a master over the congregation, rather than vice versa. In kein heim shneihem avadim ze lazeh. The relationship between the rabbi and the community is reciprocal. U'chahai gavna afilu zulatam ha'kablanut eino yachol lachzor. And therefore, yeah, so, of course, I don't think it applies to American rabbis who are entirely slaves of the congregation, I think, but it certainly applies to professors, I would imagine. So that therefore, I am not covered by Rav's halacha according to this analysis. וראשי חדשים ודמי רגל וכיוצא בהם יש לו מדהבי כקבלנות אבל גב דיקנה מסחיות השבוע מכל מקום לא קלוש השיבור על ידי זה ולפי זה יש כאן שני שיובודים אחד קבלנות ושניים בית סחיות כאבד ויש לו מדה דומיה דקניח וחמור etc. etc. So I think we will stop here. It's a lengthy tshuva, and then he goes back into the fact that there's a moral obligation and that it's a chilul Hashem if rabbis would renege on their duties. It gets a little bit more emotional as it goes on. I think you get the general thrust of the opinion. Okay. So we'll stop with this particular subject. It's a long tshuva. You can read the rest of it on your own. Okay. All right. Now, let's turn to another fact that we touched on last time because we got into medical fees, but we should look at a little bit more closely tonight as a secondary matter. We saw that the Gemara says that one of the things that the master can do in the case of a davar ha'aved is to trick the worker, promise him that he's going to increase the salary, but then at the end, not increase the salary. The general principle being that although we maintain that a kinyan that's made under duress is valid, right? Someone puts a gun to your head and forces you to sell, if the sale is at market price, in general, the law does not want to interfere with contracts, because any person is under a certain amount of duress when he agrees to something, right? He's under some financial pressure, he needs cash, he sells his house. So that if you start to use duress as a reason for vitiating contracts, then you're never going to have any free market in anything. On the other hand, that's only when it's the market price, right? If I hold you up and force you to sell me your Porsche for $300 when it's worth $30,000, that's robbery. It's not called a sale. And therefore, the question is, what happens when a person agrees to something under duress? Is that fee collectible or not? The Gemara in Bava Kamma that we briefly mentioned last time explains the case of a man who's escaping from jail. And he gets to the river, and there's a ferry, a small boat that can take him across the river, and there's a normal price, and the guy demands an outrageous price, right? There's a storm, and the taxi decides to charge 10 times the normal fee to get you home from the airport.
It's
happened, right. So the question, the Gemara says that if a person, the man, agrees under duress to pay the taxi 10 times as much. By the time he gets home, he doesn't have to pay that. He pays the market price, or maybe something a little bit more if there's some additional expenses. But an agreement to pay something which is made under duress in a gouging situation, in a blackmail situation, is not collectible. What? The sugi and Rav Abbasah is tova zavin zvine zvine means that the contract is valid if it's at the market price. I force you, I put pressure on you to sell me your house, okay? But the actual price of the sale is within the ballpark of a market price. Then the sale is valid, because we don't want to get into the question of what constitutes duress. Right? If you start to worry about, maybe duress because you had gambled at the racetrack and lost $100,000 yesterday, and you're forced to get the cash in a hurry to make sure that your knees aren't broken by the bookie. I mean, there are all types of situations of duress where we, as a court, don't want to get involved into questioning contracts. But in a situation where it's I force you to sell me something at a much higher price, or I charge you a much higher price because you have no freedom of motion, then that type of a contract is not enforceable by the court. So if the cab driver triples the fare on you, even if you agree to it at the beginning of the ride, you're only obligated to pay approximately the normal fare, maybe a little more, but certainly not triple the price.
And if you demand it up front, you can get it back in the morning?
That's this more serious question. We'll see in this tshuva, the Maram, he maintains that you can't get it back from him later, but other poskim say that you can, in fact, get it back from him later. So let's look at a couple, yes?
About the rest, I mean, if for example, as has happened, if people burn a cross on the lawn of a Jew or a black man, or a Jew does it to intimidate another Jew, and pays the market rate for the house that he's essentially evicting the people from, that would pass?
Yeah, that would pass. That would pass. I mean, there always are exceptions to the rule, but the general principle is that the halacha doesn't want to get into the motives of why someone agrees to a contract, provided that the